Side 13. The Shining Ones. The Tomilly, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 449. When they reached the tip of the reef, the flotilla of rafts split up into two separate fleets. Queen Betwana and Engesa took the Etons and made their way along the outer edge of the half-submerged forest toward the pier that thrust out from shore, while Sparhawk and his friends took the Poloi and the knights for whom there had not been room aboard Sorgai's ships along the cliff face, with Khalad and Barret scouting ahead in the skiff, since even Sorgai's 100 ships and the large number of rafts were not enough to carry all their forces. They had been obliged to leave a sizable portion of their army on the south beach, along with Sophronia, Talon, Flute, and Zanisha.
"It's shoaling," Ulaf said after about half an hour. "I think we're getting closer to shore."
"More of the trees are sticking up out of the water as well," Carlton added. "I'll definitely be glad to get off this raft. It's a nice enough raft, I suppose, but pushing it through the water with a 20-foot pole is sort of like trying to tip over a house."
The skiff came ghosting back out of the fog.
"You'd better start keeping your voices down, my lords," Khalad said in a hoarse whisper. "We're getting closer."
He reached out with one hand to steady the skiff.
"We're in luck, though. There used to be a road running parallel to the beach. At least I think it was a road. Anyway, the road, or whatever it was, gives us an open channel through the trees, and the trees between us and the beach will keep the workmen from seeing us."
"And probably keep us from getting ashore as well," Tinian added.
"No, Sir Tinian," Barret replied. "There was a meadow out there a mile or so from where the cliff is now, and that's where the pier is. All we have to do is follow that road, and it'll bring us out almost on top of the work gangs."
"Could you hear them at all?" Vanyan asked.
"Oh, yes," Khalad replied. "Almost as if they were standing about 10 feet away. And you'll start hearing their axes in just a few minutes."
He and Barret climbed aboard the raft.
"Could you make out their accents? Were they more of those Edomishmen we came up against on the south pier?"
"No, my lord. The men up here are Astels. We couldn't see the beach. But I guessed that the people giving the orders came from Ayachin's army instead of Insidi's people."
"Let's push on, then," Carlton said, hefting his pole. "Figuratively speaking, of course," he added.
"Are we all ready?" Sparhawk asked,
looking up and down the line of rafts strung out to either side.
"What is there to get ready for, Sparhawk?" Carlton asked. "If anything, Astellian serfs are going to be even more timid than those Edomish peasants were. Ulaf could probably chase them all back into the trees by just standing out here in what's left of the fog, blowing on his ogre horn."
"All right, then," Sparhawk said.
"Afriel," he threw the thought out, "are you listening?"
"Well, of course I'm listening, Sparhawk."
He decided to try a different approach. He cast his request in formal styric this time.
"An it please thee, divine Afriel, I do beseech thine aid." "Aren't you feeling well?"
Her tone was suspicious.
"I but sought to demonstrate mine unutterable regard and respect for thee, divine one." "Are you making fun of me?" "No, of course not. I just realized that I haven't been all that respectful lately. We're in position now. We're going to start moving the rafts slowly toward shore. As soon as we can make out the people on the beach, Ulaf's going to give the signal for the general attack. I'd appreciate a nice strong gust of wind at that point, if it's not too much trouble."
"Well, I'll think about it."
"Will you be able to hear Ulaf's horn? Or would you rather have me tell you when we need the wind?"
"Sparhawk, I can hear a spider walking across the ceiling of a house 10 miles away. I'll blow as soon as Ulaf does."
"That's a novel way to put it."
"Get moving, Sparhawk, or you'll run out of daylight."
"Yes, ma'am."
He looked around at the others.
"Let's get started," he told them. "The Divine One is drawing in deep breaths. I think she plans to blow the fog all the way to the pole."
The rafts inched forward, concentrating on staying in a straight line so that none of them emerged from the fog before the others. They could clearly hear the voices speaking in Alenic from the shore now, and the faint lapping of wavelets sloshing over the protruding roots of the trees off to the left.
6 feet,
Carlton reported in a loud whisper, as he lifted his pole out of the water.
We can make a mounted charge when it shoals down to 4.
If the fog holds out that long,
Evier amended. They crept on, with the water shoaling under their rafts inch by inch as they eased closer to shore. They heard the sound of a heavy blow, and curses spat out in archaic Alenic.
That's one of Ayachin's men,
Khalad whispered.
Ayachin himself wouldn't be here, would he?
Barret asked.
Incides was, so I wouldn't discount the possibility.
If Ayachin is here, I want you two to go looking for Elrond, Sparhawk instructed. We lost Amador, but Zanisha should be able to get the same kind of information out of Elrond. Don't let him get away, or get himself killed.
3 feet,
Carlton announced in a triumphant whisper.
We can charge just as soon as we catch sight of them.
The rafts inched closer, and the voices ahead were much louder now.
There's something moving,
Khalad said, pointing at a dim shape ahead.
How far?
Sparhawk asked, peering into the white blankness ahead.
Maybe 30 paces.
Then Sparhawk saw more of the dark outlines in the fog, and heard the sound of men slogging through shallow water.
Mount up, he commanded in a low voice, and signal the other rafts.
They pulled themselves slowly into their saddles, being careful not to make any noise.
All right, Ulath, Sparhawk said aloud. Let everybody know that we're starting.
Ulath grinned and lifted the curled ogre horn to his lips. Chapter 30. It was more like a gale than a breeze, and it came howling out of nowhere, bending the evergreens and tearing the last of the leaves from birch and aspen. The fog streamed away in the leaf-speckled blast, the crests of the shallow waves were suddenly whipped to froth, and the water ran against a shoreline that was not sand, nor gravel, nor rock, but grass and half-submerged bushes. There were thousands of men on shore, roughly dressed serfs, laboring in a field of tree stumps.
"Heretic knights!"
a man at the edge of the water screamed. He wore crude bits and pieces of ancient armor, and he stood gaping at the huge force of mounted men which had appeared quite suddenly out of nowhere, as the gale tore the fog away. Ulath's horn continued its barbaric call, and Takumi's Poloi and the knights plunged off the rafts, their mounts sending great sheets of water out to either side, almost like icy wings.
"What must we do, noble Ayachin?"
the crudely armored man shrieked to a lean fellow astride a white horse. The mounted man was more completely armored, although his armor was an archaic blend of steel plate and bronze chainmail.
"Fight!" he roared. "Destroy the heretic invaders! Fight for Estelle and our holy faith!"
Sparhawk sawed Farron's reins around and charged directly at the resurrected Estellian hero, his sword aloft and his shield in front of his body. Ayachin's helmet had no visor as such, but rather a steel nose guard, protruding down over half his face. There was a quick intelligence in that face, and a burning zeal. The eyes, however, were the eyes of a fanatic. He set himself, raised his heavy sword, and spurred his white mount forward to meet Sparhawk's charge. The two horses crashed together, and the white mount reeled back. Farron was the bigger horse, and he was skilled at fighting. He slammed his shoulder into Ayachin's mount and tore great chunks from the white animal's neck with his teeth. Sparhawk caught the ancient hero's sword stroke with his shield and countered with a heavy overhead stroke of his own, clashing his blade down on the hastily raised and bulky shield.
"Heretic!"
Ayachin snarled.
"Spawn of hell! Foul sorcerer!"
"Give it up!" Sparhawk snapped. "You're out of your class!"
He found that he had no real wish to kill this man who was fighting to defend his homeland and his faith from a brutal church policy long since abandoned. Sparhawk had no real quarrel with him. Ayachin bellowed his defiance and swung his sword again. He showed some proficiency with the weapon, but he was no real match for the black-armored Pandian he faced. Sparhawk caught the sword stroke with his shield again and struck a chopping blow at his opponent's shoulder.
"Run away, Ayachin," he barked. "I don't want to kill you." You've been duped by an alien god and dragged thousands of years into the future. This isn't your fight. Take your people and go.
It was too late, though. Sparhawk saw the madness in his opponent's eyes, and he had been in too many fights not to recognize it. He sighed, crowded Farron in against the white horse, and began a series of strokes he had used so many times in the past that once it began, the succeeding blows were automatic. The ancient shade fought bravely, struggling to respond with his unwieldy equipment, but the outcome was inevitable. Sparhawk's progressive strokes bit him deeper and deeper, and chunks of his armor flew from each savage cut. Then, altering his last stroke to avoid a grotesque maiming, Sparhawk thrust instead of delivering the customary overhand stroke, which would have split his opponent's head. His sword point crunched through the ancient and ineffective armor and smoothly ran through Ayachin's chest. The fire went out of that ancient face, and the hero Ayachin stiffened and toppled slowly from his saddle. Sparhawk raised his sword hilt to his face in a sad salute. A great cry went up from the Estellian serfs as Ayachin's army vanished. A burly serf at the water's edge bawled contradictory orders, gyrating his arms like a windmill. Barret leaned over in his saddle and brought the flat side of his axe blade down on top of the man's head, felling him instantly. There were a few pockets of ineffective and half-hearted resistance, but the serfs for the most part fled. Queen Betwana and her Aetons drove the panicky workers from the pier, and the knights in the Paloi parted ranks to permit them to flee into the forest. Sparhawk rose in his stirrups and looked to the north. The knights from Sorgai's ships were driving the misguided serfs on the far side of the pier back into the trees. The battle, such as it had been, was over. The Queen of the Aetons came ashore with a look of discontent on her golden face.
"It was not much of a fight, Sparhawk Knight," she accused.
"I'm sorry, Your Majesty," he apologized. "I did the best I could with what I had to work with. I'll try to do better next time."
She suddenly grinned at him.
"I was teasing you, Sparhawk Knight. Good planning reduces the need for fighting, and you plan well."
"Your Majesty is kind to say so."
"How long will it take that Camorian sailor to bring the rest of our army to the side of the wall?"
"The rest of today and most of tomorrow, I'd imagine."
"Can we afford to wait that long? We should go to Tezada before the troll beasts start to march."
"I'll talk with Afriel and Belium, Your Majesty," he said. "They'll be able to tell us what the trolls are doing, and delay them if necessary." Khalad rode up.
"We couldn't find any sign of Elrond, Sparhawk," he reported. "We captured a few of those serfs, and they told us that he wasn't here."
"Who was in charge, then?"
"That husky fellow Barret put to sleep with the flat of his axe seems to have been the one giving all the orders."
"Wake him up and see what you can get out of him. Don't twist him too hard, though. If he decides to be stubborn, we'll wait until Zanisha gets here. She can find out everything he knows without hurting him."
"Yes, my lord."
Khalad wheeled his mount and went looking for Barret.
"You have a kindly disposition for a warrior, Sparhawk Knight," Betwana observed.
"These serfs aren't really our enemies, Betwana Queen. I'll show you the other side of my nature after we catch Zalasta."
"His name is Torbic,"
Khalad reported when he joined them in the pavilion they had erected for the ladies.
"He was one of Saber's first followers. I think he's a serf from Baron Kotick's estate. He wouldn't say so, but I'm fairly sure he knows that Elrond is Saber."
"Does he know why Elrond sent him, rather than coming here himself?" Tinian asked.
"He hasn't a clue, or so he says," Khalad replied. "Anarae Zanisha can look inside his head and find out for sure."
He paused.
"Excuse me, Anarae," he said to the Delphaic woman. "We all keep groping for ways to describe what you do when you listen to the thoughts of others. We'd probably be a lot less offensive if you tell us the right word for it."
Zanisha, who had arrived with Sophrenia, Talon, and Flute on Sorgai's ship, with the first contingent being ferried around the reef, smiled.
"I had wondered which of you would be the first to ask," she said. "Methinks I should have known it would be thee, young master, for thine is the most practical mind in all this company. We of the Delphae do refer to this modest gift as sharing. We share the thoughts of others. We do not leech them, nor do we scoop them like struggling minnows from the dark waters of consciousness.
Would it offend you, Sir Knights, if I pointed out that it's easier to ask than to grope your way through four languages looking for the right term?
Khalad asked rather innocently.
Yes,
Banyan said.
As a matter of fact, it would offend us.
I won't point it out, then, my lord.
Khalad even managed to say it with a straight face.
Anyways, Torvik was here primarily to keep the Estellian serfs from talking with Ayachin's warriors too much. Evidently, there's a great potential for confusion in the situation. Elrond didn't want the two groups to start comparing notes.
Does he have any idea at all about where Elrond is right now?
Colton asked.
He doesn't even know where he is right now. Elrond just said a few vague things about Eastern Astel and let it go at that. Torbic wasn't really the one in charge here, any more than Ayachin was. There was a Styrek with them, and he was the one who was giving all the orders. He was probably one of the first to run off into the woods when we came ashore.
Would that have been Jarion? Bevier asked Sophrenia. Zelasta's necromancer? Somebody plucked Ayachin out of the ninth century.
It might have been, Sophrenia replied dubiously. More likely, though, it was one of Jarion's pupils. It's the initial spell that's difficult. Once the people from the past have been successfully raised, a fairly simple spell can bring them back again. I'm sure there was a Styrek south of the wall calling up Incites and his men as well. Zelasta and Ogorodjin have a large body of renegades to draw upon.
May I come in? Captain Sorgai asked from just outside the tent.
Of course, Captain,
Banyan replied.
The silvery-haired seaman came inside.
We'll have the last of your people ashore on this side of the reef by tomorrow noon, my lords, he reported. You'll want us to wait here, won't you?
Yes, Sparhawk replied. If all goes well, we'll need to go back around the reef after we've finished at Tezada.
Will the warm water hold? I'd rather not get icebound up here.
We'll see to it, Captain,
Sparhawk promised.
Sorgai shook his head.
You're a strange man, Master Clough. You can do things no one I've ever met can do.
He suddenly smiled.
But strange or not, you've thrown a lot of profit my way since you started running away from that ugly heiress.
He looked at the others.
But I'm just interrupting things here. Do you suppose I might have a word with you in private, Master Clough?
Of course.
Sparhawk rose and followed the sailor outside.
I'll get right to the point,
Sorgai said.
Do you have any further plans for these rafts? After you use them to go back around the reef, I mean?
No, I don't think so.
Would it be all right with you if I left a crew on the beach south of the reef while I run you and your friends back to Mytherian?
I have no objections, Captain. But why?
The rafts are made of very good logs, Master Clough. After your army uses them to get around the reef, they'll just be lying there. It'd be a shame to waste them. I thought I'd leave a crew to lash them together into some kind of boom. I'll come back after I drop you off in Mytherian, and we'll tow them to the timber market in Etalon. Or maybe even back to Mytherian itself. They should fetch a good price.
Sparhawk laughed.
Good old Sorgai, he said, putting a friendly hand on the sea captain's shoulder. You never overlook a chance for a profit, do you? Take the logs with my blessing.
You're a generous man, Master Clough.
You're my friend, Captain Sorgai, and I like doing things for friends.
You're my friend as well, Master Clough. The next time you need a ship, come and look me up. I'll take you anywhere you want to go.
Sorgai paused, his expression suddenly cautious.
For only half price,
he added. The village of Tezada had been abandoned several years ago, and the rampaging trolls had knocked most of the buildings down. It lay at the edge of a vast marshy meadow, with Belium's escarpment looming over it to the south. The sun was just rising far to the southeast, and the grassy meadow was thick with frost that glittered in the slanting sunlight.
"How large is the meadow, Your Majesty?"
Vanyan asked Betwana.
2 leagues across, and 6 or 8 leagues long. It will be a good battlefield."
"We were sort of hoping to avoid that, Your Majesty,"
Vanyan reminded her. Engesa was ordering his scouts out to pinpoint the exact location of the trolls.
"We were able to see them from the top of the escarpment," he told Vanyan. "They've been gathering out in the middle of the meadow every day for the past several weeks. They were too far away for us to see exactly what they've been doing, though. The scouts will locate them for us."
"What's the plan, friend Sparhawk?" Krang asked, fingering his saber hilt. "Do we march on them and then turn their gods loose on them at the last minute?"
"I want to talk with the troll gods first," Afriel said. "We want to be absolutely certain that they understand all the conditions of their release."
Vanyan rubbed at the side of his face.
"I think we'll want the trolls to come to us, instead of the other way around. Don't you, Sparhawk?"
"Definitely. But a feint of some kind should draw them out."
Sparhawk thought a moment.
"Why don't we move a mile or so into the meadow so they can see us?
Then we'll draw up in a standard formation. Knights in the center, Atons on either side, and the Poloi out on the flanks. Sirgon's got a military mind, and that formation's older than dirt. He'll think we're preparing to attack. The Sirgai are an aggressive people, and they would want to attack first. Sirgon's commanding trolls this time instead of his own people. But I think we can count on him to do what's customary."
"He might as well,"
Uloth shrugged.
"The trolls will attack as soon as they see us, no matter what Sirgon wants them to do. The idea of defending themselves won't even occur to them. They look on us as food, and somebody who sits in one place waiting for supper to come to him usually goes to bed hungry."
"Better and better," Vanyan said. "We'll hold our formation and let them get to within a few hundred yards of us. Then we'll turn the troll gods loose. They'll reclaim their trolls, and Sirgon will be left standing out there in the middle of the meadow all alone."
"Maybe not quite," Sophronia added. "He might have Zelasta with him. I certainly hope so, anyway."
"Savage,"
Vanyan said fondly to her.
"Let's leave the army here and go around to the backside of the village," Sparhawk suggested. "If we're going to talk with the troll gods, I'd rather not do it out in plain sight."
He turned Farron and led the others around the ruined village to a smaller clearing a few hundred yards to the east. Sparhawk had deliberately not closed the box after Belium had transported them to Tezada. This time he wanted his enemies to know where he was.
"Blue Rose," he said politely, "canst thou find anything amiss in our plan?"
"It seemeth sound to me, Annika," the stone replied through Vanyan's lips. "It might be prudent, however, to advise the troll gods that Sirgon may reach back into antiquity for reinforcements once he doth perceive that the trolls are no longer deceived by his assumed guise."
"Thou art wise, my friend," Sparhawk replied. "We shall so advise them."
He looked at Afriel.
"Don't pick any fights right now," he told her. "Let's try to get along with our allies, at least until the battle's over."
"Trust me," she said.
"Do I have any choice?"
"No, not really. Bring on the troll gods, Sparhawk. Let's get to work. The day won't last forever, you know."
He muttered something under his breath.
"I didn't quite hear that," she said.
"You weren't supposed to."
He raised the glowing gem.
"Please bring them forth now, my friend," he told it. "The child goddess doth grow impatient."
"I did notice that myself, Annika."
Then the vast presences of the troll gods were there, glowing blue and towering enormous.
"The time is come," Sparhawk announced in Trollish. "This is the place where Sirgon has your children. Let us join together to cause hurt to Sirgon."
"Yes,"
Gworg exulted.
"I will remind you of our compact," Afriel said. "You have given surety. I will hold you to your promises."
"Well will we keep them, Afriel."
Gworg's voice was sullen.
Let us repeat them, she said shrewdly. Promises made in haste are sometimes forgotten. Your children will no longer eat my children. Is it agreed?
Gnom sobbed his assent.
Quadge will restrain his fire, and Shli his ice. Agreed? Gworg will forbid your children to kill mine, and Zoka will permit no more than 2 cubs to each she-troll. Is it agreed?
Agreed. Agreed, Gworg said impatiently. Free us!
In a moment. Is it also agreed that your children will become mortal? That they will age and die, as do mine?
They howled in fury. They had evidently been hoping in their dim minds that she had forgotten that promise.
Agreed?
She bored in with a not-so-veiled threat in her voice.
Agreed,
Shli said reluctantly.
Turn them loose, Sparhawk.
In a minute. Then he spoke to the troll gods directly. It is our intent to cause hurt to Sirgon, he told them. Let him seem to have victory in his mouth before we jerk it from between his teeth. Thus will he suffer more.
It speaks well, Shli told the others. Let us hear its words. Let us find out how the hurt of Sirgon may be made greater.
Sparhawk quickly outlined their plan of battle. Thus, he concluded, when your children are 10 tens of strides from Afriel's children, and Sirgon exults, you can appear and tear your stolen children back from his grasp. In pain and agony may he bring his own children from the shadowy past to meet us. I will appeal to the child goddess and ask her to relent this once and let your children feast upon Sirgon's, and Sirgon himself will feel their teeth as they rend and tear the flesh of his children.
Your words are good, Annika, Shli agreed. It is my thought that you are almost worthy to be a troll.
I thank you for thinking so, Sparhawk replied a bit dubiously. The army advanced at a steady trot. The church knights, their armor gleaming in the slanting rays of the newly risen sun, and the pennons on their lances fluttering, rode forward, the hooves of their half-trained warhorses crushing the knee-high grass of the meadow. The unmounted Etons loped along on either side, and Takumi's Paloi, probably the finest light cavalry in the world, ranged out on the flanks. Despite Vanyan's violent objections, Sophrenia and Zanisha rode with the knights. Flute, for some obscure reason, rode with Talon this time. They had trotted perhaps 2 miles out into the frost-white meadow when Vanyan held up his hand to signal a halt. Ulaf blew a long, strident blast on his ogre horn to pass the word, and Gessa, Betwana, and Kring joined them.
We have more details now, Betwana told them. Some of our scouts concealed themselves in the high grass to watch the trolls. Sirgon is exhorting the man-beasts, and there are several Styriks with him. My people don't know the language of those monsters, so they couldn't understand what Sirgon was saying.
It's not too hard to guess, Tinian shrugged. We've got quite an army here, and we've drawn up in the traditional battle formation. I'm sure Sirgon thinks we're planning to attack the trolls. He's preparing them for battle.
Could your scouts recognize any of the Styriks, Betwana?
Sophrenia asked, her face grim. The Etan queen shook her head.
They couldn't get that close, she replied.
Zalasta is there, Sophrenia, Zanisha said. I can feel the presence of his mind.
Can you hear his thoughts, Anare? Vivier asked her.
Not clearly, Sir Knight. He is not yet close enough.
Vanyan frowned.
I wish we could get some assurance that this ruse of ours is working, he fretted. This could turn very ugly if Zalasta's got any ideas at all of what we're planning. Could your scouts get any kind of estimate about how many trolls are out there, Your Majesty?
Perhaps 1,500, Vanyan Preceptor, Betwana replied.
That's almost the whole herd, Ulaf observed. There aren't really very many trolls.
He made a wry face.
There don't really have to be. One troll's a crowd all by himself in a fight.
If we were planning a battle, would we have enough men? Tinian asked them.
Ulof wobbled one hand back and forth uncertainly.
"It'd be touch and go," he replied. "We've only got about 12,000. Attacking 1,500 trolls with so few would be an act of desperation."
"Our ruse is believable, then," Venyan said. "Sirgon and Zalasta shouldn't have any reason to suspect a trap."
They waited. The horses of the knights were restive, and some grew more difficult to control as the minutes ticked by. Then an Aton woman came running back across the frosty meadow.
"They've started to move, Betwana Queen," she shouted from about 100 yards out.
"It worked, then," Talon said gleefully.
"We'll see,"
Khalad said cautiously.
"Let's not start dancing in the streets just yet."
The scout came the rest of the way across the meadow to join them.
"Tell us what you saw," Betwana commanded. "The man-beasts are coming toward us, Betwana Queen," the woman replied. "They move singly, some far to the front and others lagging behind."
"Trolls wouldn't understand the concept of fighting as a unit," Ulof told them.
"Who commands them?" Betwana asked.
"Something that is very large and ugly, Betwana Queen," the scout reported. "The man-beasts around it are taller than any Aton, and they scarcely come as high as its waist. There are styrets with it as well. 8, by my count."
"Did one of them have silvery hair and a beard?" Sophronia asked intently.
"There are 2 such. One is thin and one is fat. The thin one is close by the big ugly thing."
"That one is Zalasta," she said in a bleak voice.
"I'll take a promise from you now, Sophronia," Vanyan said firmly.
"You can go whistle for promises, Vanyan,"
she said tartly. She was flexing her fingers in an ominous sort of way.
"You were right, Sparhawk Knight," Engessa said with a faint smile. "When we reached Sarsos last summer, you said Sophronia was 200 feet tall. She does seem to grow as one comes to know her better, doesn't she? I don't think I'd care to trade places with Zalasta right now."
"No," Sparhawk agreed. "That wouldn't be a good idea." "Will you at least agree to think just a little before you start grappling with Zalasta?" Venyan pleaded. "For my sake? My heart stops when you're in danger."
She smiled at him.
"That's very sweet, Venyan, but I'm not the one in danger just now."
Then they heard it. It was a dull, rhythmic thudding of hundreds of feet striking the earth in rhythmic unison, and that thudding was accompanied by a low, brutish grunting. Then the thudding and grunting suddenly broke off, and a shrill, wailing ululation rose, fluctuating and piercing the chill air.
"Kring!"
Ulof barked.
"Let's go have a look!"
And the two galloped out across the frozen meadow.
"What is it?" Vanyan asked.
"Very bad news," Colton replied tensely. "We've heard that noise before. When we were on our way to Zemok, we came across some creatures Sophronia called the Dawn Men. They make trolls look like tame puppies by comparison."
"And the troll gods wouldn't have any authority over them," Sophronia added. "We might have to retreat."
"Never!" Betwana almost shouted. "I won't run away again, not from anything. I've been humiliated too many times already. My Aetons and I will die here if necessary."
Ulof and Kring came riding back, their faces baffled.
"They're just ordinary trolls," Ulof exclaimed, "but they're stamping and grunting and wailing the same way the Dawn Men did."
Flute suddenly burst out laughing.
"What's so funny?" Talon demanded.
"Sirgon," she replied gaily. "I knew he was stupid, but I didn't think he was this stupid. He can't tell the difference between trolls and Dawn Men. He's forcing the trolls to behave the way their ancestors did, and that won't work with trolls. All he's doing is confusing them. Let's go out and meet them, Sparhawk. I want to watch Sirgon's face crumble and fall off the front of his head."
Then she drove her little grass-stained feet into the flanks of Talon's horse, obliging the rest of them to follow along behind. They crested a low hill and reined in. The trolls were advancing through the tall grass on a broad front, quite nearly a mile across, shuffling, stamping their heels, and grunting in unison. A vast shape that very closely resembled Gorg, the god of Kill, shambled along in the center of the brutish throng, beating on the frozen ground with a huge iron-bound club. The monstrous apparition was closely surrounded by a group of white-robed Styrix. Sparhawk could quite clearly see Zalasta at Sirgon's right.
"Sirgon!"
Afriel called. Her voice was shatteringly loud. Then she spoke at some length in a language that had only traces of Styrix in it, and was shaded around the edges with bits and pieces of Alenic and Tamil, and a half-dozen other languages as well.
"What tongue is that?" Betwana demanded.
"It is the language of the gods," Vanyan replied,
his voice carrying that slightly wooden overtone that always overlaid it when Belium spoke.
"The child goddess doth taunt Sirgon."
Vanyan seemed to wince slightly.
"Thou wert perhaps unwise to expose thy goddess overmuch to Aline's, Sophrenia," Belium observed. "Her capacity for imprecation and insult seemeth to me inappropriate for one so young."
"Afriel is hardly young, Blue Rose,"
she replied. A faint smile touched Vanyan's lips.
"Not to thee, perhaps. Perspective, however, doth color all. To me, thy seemingly ancient goddess is scarce more than a babe."
"Be nice,"
Afriel murmured. Then she continued to rail at the now enraged Sirgon.
"Can you hear Zalasta's thoughts now, Anaray?" Calton asked.
"Clearly, Sir Knight,"
Zenisha replied.
"Does he have any suspicion at all about what we're going to do?"
"Nay, he doth believe that victory is within his reach."
Afriel stopped in mid-curse.
"Let's disabuse him of that right now," she said. "Turn loose the troll god, Sparhawk."
"An it please thee, Blue Rose," Sparhawk said politely. "Evict thine unwanted tenants now."
"More than gladly, Annika,"
Belium replied with great relief. The troll gods were not surrounded by that azure nimbus this time. They appeared suddenly and in vividly excruciating detail. Sparhawk suppressed a wave of revulsion.
"Go to your children, Gwarg," Afriel commanded in Trollish. "It is your semblance Sirgon has stolen, and it is your right to cause hurt to him for that."
Gwarg roared his agreement and charged down the hill with the other troll gods close on his heels. The counterfeit Gwarg gaped up the hill at the dreadful reality descending upon him, and then he screamed in sudden agony.
"That is Sirgon, isn't it?" Calton shouted.
"Does that even happen to gods?"
Talon asked Flute.
"Does it hurt you as much as it hurts humans to have one of your spells broken?"
"Even more,"
she almost purred.
"Sirgon's brains are on fire right now."
The trolls were also gaping at their suddenly materialized gods. One huge brute, not far from the writhing god of the Sirgai, reached out almost absently, picked up a shrieking Styrix, and pulled off his head. Then he tossed the head aside and began to eat the still convulsing body. The troll gods roared something in unison, and the trolls all fell on their faces. Sirgon writhed, shrieking, and the seven remaining Styrix collapsed as if they had been cut down. The false shape of Gwarg shuddered away into nothingness, and Sirgon himself suddenly appeared as an amorphous blob of pale, intense light. Afriel sneered.
"That's Sirgon for you," she noted. "He claims to be too proud to assume a human form. Personally, I think he's just too clumsy. If he tried, he'd probably put the head on upside down, or both arms on the same side."
She shrieked a few more triumphant insults.
"Afriel!"
Sophrenia actually sounded shocked.
"I've been saving those up,"
the child goddess apologized.
"You weren't really supposed to hear me say them."
Sirgon's fire was fluctuating wildly now, flaring and dimming as his agony swelled and then diminished.
"What is Zalasta feeling now?"
Sophrenia eagerly asked Zanisha.
"His pain doth go beyond mine ability to describe it,"
the NRA replied.
"Dear, dear sister," Sophrenia exulted, "you've made me happier than you could possibly imagine."
"Are you ever going to be able to tame her again?" Sparhawk asked Vanyan.
"It may take a while."
Vanyan's tone was troubled. The writhing, half-formed shape of the flame-like Sirgon partially rose and waved one huge fiery arm, and a half mile or so behind the trolls, there suddenly appeared a vast glittering.
"He's called up his seer guy," Khalad shouted. "We'd better do something."
"Gworg! Shlee!"
Vanyan roared in Belium's huge voice.
"Sirgon hath summoned his children. Now may your children feast."
The troll gods swelled even more enormous and barked sharp commands to their prostrate worshippers. The trolls scrambled to their feet, turned, and looked hungrily at the advancing seer guy drawn from ages past. Then, with a great roar, they rushed toward the banquet Sirgon had so generously provided. Elana was tired. It had been one of those exhausting days with so many things to do that nothing had been really wrapped up before the next intruded itself. She had retired with Mirtai, Aileen, and Melodir to prepare for bed. Danae trailed along behind them, dragging Rollo by one hind leg and yawning broadly.
"The Emperor was in a peculiar humor this evening,"
Melodir noted, closing the door behind them.
"Sarabian's nerves are strung a little tight right now,"
Elana said, sitting down at her dressing table.
"The future of his whole empire hinges on what Sparhawk and the others are doing in the north, and there's no way he can keep track of what's going on up there."
Danae yawned again and curled up in a chair.
"Where's your cat?"
Elana asked her.
"She's around somewhere,"
Danae replied sleepily.
"Check my bed, Mirtai,"
Elana instructed.
"I don't like furry little surprises in the middle of the night."
Mirtai patted down the canopied royal bed, and then dropped to her knees to look under all the furniture.
"No sign of her, Elana," she reported.
"You'd better go find her, Danae,"
the queen said.
"I'm sleepy, mother,"
Danae objected.
"The sooner you find your cat, the sooner you can get to bed. Let's catch her before she gets out of the castle this time. Go with her, Mirtai. After you two find the cat, put Danae to bed, and then see if you can locate either Stragan or Kaalador. One of them's supposed to bring me a report on what's going on at the Seneskan Embassy tonight, and I'd like to get it out of the way before I go to bed. I don't want them banging on my door in the middle of the night."
Mirtai nodded.
"Come along, Danae," she said.
The princess sighed. She climbed out of her chair, kissed her mother, and followed the golden giantess out of the room. Aileen began to brush the queen's hair. Elana loved to have her hair brushed. There was a kind of sleepy, sensual delight in it that relaxed her tremendously. She was quite vain about her hair. It was thick and heavy and lustrously blonde. Its pale color was astounding to the dark-haired Tamils, and she knew that all eyes would be on her any time she entered a room. The three of them talked the drowsy, intimate talk of ladies preparing for bed. Then there was a polite tapping at the door.
"Oh, bother,"
Elana said. "See who that is, Melodir."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
The Baroness rose to her feet and crossed the bedroom to the door. She opened it and spoke for a moment with the people outside.
"It's four of the Paloi, Your Majesty,"
she said.
"They say they have word from the north."
"Bring them in, Melodir." Elana turned to face the door. The man who came through the door wore typical Paloi clothing, tight-fitting and mostly leather, with a saber at his waist. His head was shaved, as were the heads of all Paloi men, but this fellow's face was slightly tanned, whereas his scalp was as pale as the belly of a fish. Something was wrong here. The man behind the first wore a carefully trimmed black beard. His face was very pale, and it looked somehow familiar. The last two also wore Paloi garb and had shaved their heads, but they were definitely not Paloi. The first was Elrond, the juvenile Estellian poet, and the second, pouchy-eyed and slightly tipsy, was Craeger.
"Ah," he said in his drink-slurred voice, "so good to see you again, Your Majesty."
"How did you get in here, Craeger?" she demanded.
"Nothing easier, Elana,"
he smirked.
"You should have kept a few of Sparhawk's knights to stand watch. Church knights are more observant than Tamil soldiers. We dressed as Paloi, shaved our heads, and no one gave us a second glance. Elrond here covered his face with his cloak when the Baroness answered the door, just as a precaution. but otherwise it was almost too easy. You have met Elrond before, haven't you?
I vaguely remember him. Don't you, Melodir?
Why, yes, I believe so, Your Majesty,
the blind girl replied.
Wasn't he that literary incompetent we met back in Astel?
Elrond's face went suddenly white with outrage.
I'm not an expert in poetry, ladies,
Craeger shrugged.
Elrond tells me that he's a poet, so I take him at his word. May I present Baron Perak?
He indicated the first man who had entered the room. Perak bowed floridly. His face was marked with the purplish broken veins of a heavy drinker, and his eyes were pouchy and dissipated-looking. Elana ignored him. You're not going to get out of here alive, Craeger. You know that, don't you?
I always get out alive, Elana,
he smirked.
My preparations are very thorough. Now I'd like to have you meet our leader. This is Scarpa.
He gestured at the bearded man.
I'm sure you've heard of him, and he's been absolutely dying to make your acquaintance.
He doesn't look at all that dead to me.
Yet,
she noted. Why don't you call the guards to remedy that, Melodir?
Scarpa blocked the Baroness. This bravado is quite out of place, he said to Elana coldly, in a voice loaded with contempt. You give yourself too many airs. All the genuflecting and your majesties seem to have gone to your head and made you forget that you're still only a woman.
I don't think I need instruction in proper behavior from the bastard son of a whore, she retorted.
Scarpa's face flickered a brief annoyance. We're wasting time, he said. His voice was deep and rich, the voice of a performer, and his manner and gestures were studied. He had obviously spent a great deal of time in the public eye. We have many leagues to cover before dawn.
I'm not going any place, she declared.
You'll go where I tell you to go, he said, and I'll teach you your place as we go along.
What do you hope to gain from this?
Melodir demanded.
Empire and victory.
Scarpa shrugged.
We are taking the Queen of Alenia hostage. Her husband is so stupid that he forgets that the world is full of women, one very much like another. He's so foolishly attached to her that he'll give us anything for her safe return.
Are you such an idiot that you actually believe that my husband will trade Belium for me? Elana said scornfully. Sparhawk is Annika, you fool, and he has Belium in his fist. That makes him a god. He killed Azash. He'll kill Sirgon, and he'll definitely kill you. Pray that he does it quickly, Scarpa. He has it in his power to make your dying last for a million years if he chooses.
I do not pray, woman. Only weaklings put any faith in gods.
I think you underestimate Sparhawk's devotion to you, Elana,
Craeger said.
He'll give anything to gain your safe return.
He won't have to, Elana snapped. I'll deal with the four of you myself. Do you really think you can get out of here, when one word from me will bring half the garrison running?
You won't give that word, however, Scarpa sneered. You're just a little too arrogant, woman. I think you need to know the full reality of your situation.
He turned and pointed at Baroness Melodir.
Kill that one, he commanded Elrond.
But
the pasty-faced literary poseur began to object. Kill her, Scarpa snapped. If you don't, I'll kill you.
Elrond tremblingly drew his rapier and advanced on the defiant Baroness.
It's not a knitting needle, you clot,
Melodir told him.
You can't even hold it right. Stick to butchering language, Elrond. You don't have the skill or the stomach to move up to people yet, although your so-called poetry's bad enough to make people want to die.
How dare you!
He almost screamed, his face turning purple.
How's your ode to blue coming, Elrond?
She taunted him.
You could make a fortune peddling that one as an emetic, you know. I felt the urge to vomit before you'd finished reciting the first stanza.
He howled in absolute rage and made a clumsy thrust with his rapier. Elana had watched Stragan training Sarabian often enough to know that the thrust was off the mark. The intrepid Baroness coolly deflected the blade with the wrist of the hand she seemed to be raising in a futilely defensive gesture, and Elrond's blade passed smoothly through her shoulder. Melodir gasped,
clutching at the blade to conceal the exact location of the wound. Then she lurched back to pull herself free and clawed at the wound, spreading the blood spurting from it over the bodice of her nightdress. Then she fell.
"You murderer!"
Ilana shrieked, rushing to her fallen friend. She hurled herself across Melodir's inert body, weeping and crying out in apparent anguish.
"Are you all right?"
she muttered under her breath between sobs.
"It's only a scratch,"
Melodir lied, also in a whisper.
"Tell Sparhawk that I'm all right," the queen instructed,
tugging off her ring and concealing it in Melodir's bodice.
"And I forbid him to give up Belium, no matter what they threaten to do to me."
She rose to her feet, her face tear-streaked.
"You'll hang for this, Elrond," she said in a deadly voice. "Or maybe I'll have you burned at the stake instead, with a slow fire."
She pulled a blanket from the bed and quickly covered Melodir with it to prevent too close an examination.
"We will leave now," Scarpa said coldly. "That other one is also your friend, I believe?"
He pointed at the ashen-faced Aileen.
"We'll take her along, and if you make any outcry at all, I'll personally slit her throat."
"You're forgetting the message, Lord Scarpa," Craeger said,
pulling a folded piece of paper from the inside of his leather Polloi jacket.
"We have to leave a friendly little note for Sparhawk, just to let him know that we stopped by to call."
Then he drew a small knife.
"Your pardon, Queen Aelana," he smirked,
exhaling the sharp, acrid reek of his wine-sodden breath into her face.
"But I need a bit of authentication to prove to Sparhawk that we're really holding you captive."
He took hold of a lock of Aelana's hair and roughly sawed it off with his knife.
"We'll just leave this with our note, so that he can compare it with later ones to verify that it's really yours."
His grin grew even more vicious.
"If you should feel a sudden urge to cry out, Aelana, just remember that all we really need is your head. We can harvest hair from that, so we won't need to bring the rest of you along if you start being too much bother."
Thus concludes the tale of The Shining Ones, the second book in the saga of the Tamali, in The Hidden City, the final volume in David Edding's stirring epic. Sparhawk and Aelana face the ultimate challenge in a distant and merciless land. End of The Shining Ones, The Tamali, Book 2, by David Eddings. Read by Eric Sandvold, in the studios of Talking Book Publishers, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, July 1994. For special distribution, as authorized by Act of Congress, under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Valentine Books, a division of Random House, Incorporated, New York, New York, 10022. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.